Welcome to the A Minute to Midnight show, folks. This is Tony coming to you from New Zealand, and I'm always really very interested to have Stan Deo on the A Minute to Midnight show. Stan's been a guest a few times now, and back today, there's a lot to talk about. So, Stan, it's awesome to have you back on the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Tony. There's certainly a lot of stuff happening down in your neck of the world and over in Australia as well that certainly bears discussion.
Yeah, so it's like so much. Where do we start?
Yeah. Well, let's look at Australia for a second, because that we've been puzzling, you know, as Christians, why Australia is being punished so much, you know. And one of the things that we wondered about was they've been letting a lot of Muslims into the country, and they've been forming pockets of you know, not joining the rest of the community there. And you can't even walk in certain areas of Sydney or Melbourne because they're occupied like a little Arab community. You'll get beat up and stuff like that. And because this is like Islam and they're just letting it go rampant there, I think that God may be saying to Australia, you better stop that. You know, this is not good. You're moving away from it, going the wrong direction. However, I could be wrong, but when you look at the map of all the fires in Australia, wow. And look at the 1 billion animals that they know of that have been killed. I mean, this is catastrophic. It's going to set Australia's economy back years. So, you know, why is this happening to them? Are you having fires over New Zealand at all?
No, not at all. We're not having the high temperatures that they've had in Australia either. It's not been anything like that here.
You got to wonder why them. You know, I mean, you're so close. You're just across the pond from them. So I don't know what's happening there. My children are okay over on the west coast of Australia. They've only seen the odd fire, but nothing serious. But anyway, it's almost apocalyptic, as though something, you know, God was punishing Australia for something. We've been trying to figure out what in the world that might be. Anyway, that's hot there. There are other places that are cold and wet. The climate is changing. It's not just weather, the climate, you know, long-term changes are being made. And I've always said, as you know, that the major climate driver for Earth is the sun. It's not, you know, global warming, you know. And on that subject, I was talking to you before we went on air about Dr. Patrick Michaels. He's the director of the Center for Study of Science at the Cato Institute, and they look into climate change, and they study the politics as well and the relation between the two. And I watched an interview with him and Mark Levin, which you can, if you get there this week, you can see my link on slide 59 to the interview. And this guy starts telling you scientifically why it's a bunch of malarkey about global warming. And he says he's looked at the equations that they've set up, the various institutes have set up to forecast, you know, global conditions and change in climatology. And he says every one of them without fail does this. They parameterize a couple of the key factors that are needed to calculate the future, you know, the temperatures and stuff like that. And he says parameterize means they fudge it because they have several key factors that they need to have in the equations. And there's no data for it, so they kind of estimate what it should be based on 1900 to 2000 data, and they plug it. And every one of them do this, and what happens is the temperature graph for the planet just goes, you know, in a very rapid arc rise. And if you look underneath his graph, which he's got on his website there at, the Cato Institute, you'll see that there are graphs of the projections for, say, the last 10 years and graphs of what's actually happened underneath it. And the projections are like skyrocketing, but what's happening is not. It's kind of a little bit elevated, but nothing to worry about. It's almost a straight line. And he said, this is the difference between, you know, not fudging the factors, but using the factors correctly. And you see that this is what we're observing. I mean, you just got to look. It's empirical. If what they're predicting with their equations isn't happening, something's wrong with their equations. So, yeah, this is just an ongoing bit of political stuff to set up a world government, I'm sure, you know, because everybody's frightened to death and you don't want to have carbon emissions and, you know, cow gas and whatever. This is just garbage. I mean, history shows ice ages. History shows heat waves. A factor of like 2 degrees centigrade plus or minus on the average temperature of the planet can throw us into an ice age or, you know, a really hot series of centuries. But anyway, this is just malarkey.
You know, well, you mentioned Australia. I saw a video of an interview. I think it was on Sky Australia, where this particular lady, whose name escapes me, but is an expert, and she was talking about how they've actually changed the historical data for Australia and dropped a lot of the temperatures from the past, whilst, you know, against the modern temperatures, instead of using the actual recorded temperatures, they're saying, oh, no, these were wrong. So they're lowering. So it makes things look hotter today based on, well, it's another part of this whole scam, really. And the other side of it, too, is I'm also seeing people going, this is child abuse that you're indoctrinating kids at school, that there's this extinction event happening and we've got to change, you know, the climate, and these poor kids are thinking we've got 11 years to live or something unless we do the, you know, it's basically child abuse. They'd be teaching little kids stuff like this that's not a settled science. There are a lot of people that are scientists like you that basically, and plenty of others that are saying, no, this is not the way it is at all. But of course there is a UN-driven agenda to push toward global government, and this is the method that they're using to do it, and silence anyone that disagrees with them.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It's for those of us that are watching this happen, I guess we probably represent maybe 4% of the population. There's about another 1% that are causing all this to happen and are scamming us. And then the 95% of people don't even know anything's happening, you know? If it interferes with their TV and their favorite series or something, they might cast an eye that direction. But otherwise, it doesn't bother them, so they don't pay attention. They're just asleep.
Yeah. But then I see these biased and slanted media articles that are supposed to be news reports, but of course all they are is an opinion that is pushing an agenda. And one I saw, I think it was on New Zealand's News Hub, I think that's where I was, and saying the warmest decade has been the 2000s, and since the 2000s, and before that, the next warmest was the 1990s, then the 1980s, then the 1970s, then the 1960s. You know, it's like, hang on a second, what? That's a load of rubbish. For a start, the 1970s, they were talking about it was cold, and it was, you know, and so, but people, the average person will read that and take it as gospel truth. You know?
Yeah, they will, because they, the scientists said this, or the government, you know, you got to trust them and they wouldn't lie. But look at the Maunder minimum in England. Now, when the Thames froze over, you know, for, gosh, 10, 12 years, something like that, and they had bazaars year-round out there on the ice of the river, right? It was really cold. During that same time over in Greenland, the weather was warm. So, it's sections or regions that are affected by changes. What's driving that? The sun and our magnetic field. Now, Earth's magnetic fields at the moment are weakening, very weak, and they are, the North and South Pole are starting to flip upside down. Now, the North Pole of the Earth is slipping, you know, upside down ahead of the South Pole. That's because the Earth has at least two and maybe three pairs of North-South poles floating around inside the planet. And NASA's modeled this. And in a planetary, you know, pole reversal, a magnetic reversal, one hemisphere will start to flip upside down before the other one. So let's take the northern hemisphere. This, what we're seeing now is that the North Pole is moving at 35 miles a year towards Siberia, which is extremely fast.
Yeah.
And if you look at the magnetic models they get from orbit at NASA, what they're seeing is two bright globs, which are red globs showing the North Pole, and it's split. There's two of them up there. And, you know, that doesn't work well. So when these things are disturbed by the sun and by our magnetic field weakening, what happens is that the weather patterns, the climate shifts, it tilts, it follows the magnetic field. And so when that happens, the heating or cooling of a region on the planet like the Thames, you know, the River Thames and stuff, that is a local event. While elsewhere on the planet, it's getting warmer. And you take the average of all these climate temperatures, and you get, well, the temperature is at 0.9 degrees C above normal for the planet. You average it, you see. But people are saying, well, this can't be right because I'm cold where I am, or I'm hot where I am. But what is happening is the magnetic field is shifting the climate patterns. away from where they were, and so you're getting a change to your own pattern.
Yeah,
with
that makes sense. So it does. I noticed, I saw an article this morning, I think, in Newfoundland, where they've had 12 feet of snow, and the airport's closed currently till at least Sunday, and that's like the most snow they've ever recorded. And so, but they won't tell you that this, the climate change people, you know, it's the Al Gore's, because unfortunately there might be some polar bears left in Newfoundland then.
Yeah, crazy devils. You know, look at Antarctica. I mean, the Pee Wee Reese maps show Antarctica without the ice cap on it. So something happened and shifted the weather change so that it froze over Antarctica in the last 500 years. You know, it wasn't always like that. It was a landmass, but it suddenly it got frozen over by changes in the climate patterns, and the whole world didn't freeze, but Antarctica did. And this is perfect example of it. And now, of course, Antarctica is undergoing change itself. On the western Antarctic glaciers, they're starting to melt because the volcanoes are erupting underneath it. And warming the surface there and starting to get rid of the ice over the land. And the Russians have a deep well over at Vostok there in the Antarctica. And they went down, gosh, several thousand feet, and they found a liquid lake with fish in it underneath all the ice down there.
Oh, wow.
I mean, this is kind of cool, right? Yeah. I mean, so these changes do happen, and nothing's like stable and static forever. And we're seeing that, as I say, in the western ice pack there on Antarctica. I can see on the graph I've got there, I can see patches of volcanic heating all the way around the whole western side. There's one area that's really, dropped a lot of ice since 1992, about 30 foot or so. And then there are other areas that are like circular little, like a single volcano, but there's about 15 of them I can see that have started to drop ice in the middle of the ice sheet, you know, and that's not sloughing off into the sea. It's just melting and going, you know, somewhere. So there are things happening there that are, you know, real interest to me anyway. And as I said, these things are linked to violent solar storms, but one of the reports I was talking about with you was about violent solar storms, how they're happening closer to Earth. Now, you can have solar storms where the solar wind hits the Earth and it changes weather. You can have a coronal mass ejection, which can generate an EMP and fry your electronics. You can have just flares. But what they're noticing now is because our magnetic field on Earth is so weakened that when the magnetic particles coming in the solar wind hit the Earth, the Earth forms a tail out away from the sun of its stretched magnetic field, and it stretches out, you know, 4 or 5 Earth diameters behind us. Sometimes now what is happening is the magnetic lines in the Earth's field will break for just a short period of time, you know, a few seconds, and then they will reconnect, and it's called a reconnection event, and it snaps like a rubber band, and it generates a horrific magnetic pulse all over the planet because of that reconnection of our own magnetic field. This happens on the sun, and you get a solar flare and you get a coronal mass ejection, but we're having miniature versions of that more often now on Earth's magnetic field. So we're seeing events, magnetic storm events, happen at odd places on the Earth and not always facing the sun. Anyway, this is just another thing.
Why is the Earth's magnetic field weakening?
Well, it periodically undergoes a magnetic reversal of the poles, and maybe every 10,000 years or whatever. And right now, the empirical data, the test data, is showing that our magnetic field is almost, you know, to the point where it could flip. And this has been accelerating more rapidly as the data has been taken. For instance, in the last 10 years, they've had a number of the airports here in the Northern Hemisphere have had to relabel their runways, you know, magnetic 292 instead of, you know, 282. I mean, 5 to 10 degree shifts in your magnetic field that rapidly tell you we've got a problem happening right now. And at the rate we're seeing it, we could lose our magnetic field for a year as it undergoes this zero point and starts to build back up to a stable north and south pole. And that magnetic field shields us from cosmic radiation. It shields us from solar radiation. And, you know, without that, we're in deep, deep trouble. A lot of things will die on the planet. Some of that radiation getting in will kill animals and plant life.
That's a bit of a sobering thought. What about things like the Carrington event from 1859, I think it was? 1859, I got it in front of me. Powerful geomagnetic storm during a solar cycle 10. Now, perhaps you could explain to the listeners very briefly what that's all about, because I'm sure some probably won't know. And then what it could mean if we had something similar happen today, and is there any reason why it couldn't, basically?
All right. Well, these solar storms are caused by a variety of events on the sun, solar, obviously. The magnetic fields are in the sunspots on the sun. You'll have a plus and minus or north and south around a sunspot or a group of them. And these things run through periodic flip-flops every about 11.9 years in the solar cycle. And depending upon the stability of the chromosphere of the sun, you know, the outer burning atmosphere, these can generate effects that go out toward the Earth. And they don't always come toward Earth. When these events happen, they point out into space in other directions. And so we just have to be unlucky to be on the side of the sun and in a direct line of sight to one of these coronal mass ejection events or flare events. Now, in the 1859 flare, the Carrington event, it was so obvious that in England, there were bricklayers and stuff working on buildings and things. They could do it at night because the sky was so bright from the ionization of our atmosphere from the solar wind in that event hitting Earth. Now, it happens, this radiation comes in slow particles that take a day or two to get to the Earth from the sun, and also in direct radiation that gets here in 8 minutes. The 8 minute ones you've got to worry about because those create electromagnetic pulses. They bounce our magnetic field and they stress the flow of electricity all over the surface of the planet. Even though we didn't have industry then, we had earth currents called telluric currents that were stressed by this pulse of huge amount of energy, magnetic energy from the sun. Now, in the Carrington event, we had telegraph lines. That was about the extent of our electricity and some Edison distribution of power in the east, you know, very, very primitive electronics or electricity at all. And even though it was primitive, it did suffer these extreme events as the third part of an EMP occurs, called, you know, the E3. E1 and E2 are things that normally happen so quickly that it's going to affect electronics. And since we didn't have any then, it didn't affect that. And they'll last a billionth of a second. I mean, it's, you know, something here and gone before you even know it was there. However, with the railway lines and the telegraph lines following them, the E3 event is a prolonged discharge of electricity into our atmospheres. It's not billions of a second, it's hours. And that creates so much input of electricity and magnetism into our field that in the case of the 1859 event, as I told you, lit up the sky for hours in England, but it also made sparks jump out of the telegraph keys. It burned a number of key operators on their fingers because it just was such a hot arc came out and burned them. And it started fires in odd places along the telegraph line because it arced to ground. If we were to repeat the Carrington event now, the E1 and E2 events, in addition to the E3, we'd get hit with all three levels of the pulses from the sun in a magnetic event like that, and it would destroy modern civilizations, communications, and technology. It'd kick us back to the horse and buggy age because it would short out so many of our electronics just instantly. That's why my partner and I developed the EMP shield to shunt a lot of those first two events, the E1, E2, into the ground to protect electronics, you know, so it doesn't go through our electronics and through our home wiring and stuff and burn houses down. Because without that, it's going to catch fire to a lot of places as the voltage builds up on the E3 level along our power lines and starts arcing out to the ground everywhere. Now, fortunately, our government is smart enough, you know, thought way ahead of the game, and changes have been made, preparations have been made in our grid and various other places to circumvent this, to protect our power grids. We've got one or two that we're running tests on right now. My partner and I are working with the DOD on this to shield sections of the grid. So that at least we have that one still working, that kind of stuff, as we kind of do to the next one, we're building up the priority ones first. And, of course, we also have the event of North Korea and Iran and Russia and China hating us and wanting to bring us down with the EMP attack, and they can certainly do that with bombs. So that one may surprise all of us, you know, but we're betting that we'll be able to build all these safeguards in before that event war-wise happens, and with the solar system, the solar events on the sun. But the sun is misbehaving. You know, it's not being stable in what we thought was a stable model for how it generated light and heat and electricity. It's being abnormal, and it's emitting certain frequencies of wavelengths in the ultraviolet range since 1992 that we never knew were there. And scientists have built up, models, mathematical models of how the sun works and why it puts out this frequency and that range of frequency and that kind of stuff, ultraviolet and infrared and blah, blah, blah. It's not following the mathematical predictions. There's something else happening in the sun. And I suspect, for a number of reasons, that the sun is probably going to throw off a lot of its current surface into the solar system in one big event that will be very bright, and it'll pass through the solar system in a few minutes. Out to where we are, it'll take a few hours to get up to the outer edge of our system. But I look at the NASA pictures, a video, in fact, that I had up last week, showing the time-lapse photography for 8 months on the Monoceros cluster. And one star did that. It blew off its surface and, it went to a different temperature and emission, whatever. It didn't kill the star, but it blew off a shell. And it went through that entire Monoceros system in 8 months. And we could slow motion see it coming out. The gas clouds were filmed coming out. So I'm thinking that our star is subject to something like that right now. And I tie that back to biblical prophecy, Tony. The sun will be so bright, it'll be seven times the light of day now. None of us on the planet could withstand that if it was 24 hours a day. I mean, if the planet rotated one full rotation, it would fry everything, because even the Bible says when that event happens with the sun going bright like that, it's going to kill fish. It's going to fry, green grass and trees, boil the seas. Now, so how does, a third of the planet get destroyed like that and two-thirds not? It's the side facing the sun. About one-third of it is what's going to take direct radiation like that, and it will kill, like the Bible says, but the other two-thirds of the planet will heat up, but they won't have that direct radiation burst from the sun. And it also says in the prophecy how the sun will have a cloud around it. Now, what causes that cloud? The release of the particles of the surface of the sun as it starts to expand that out and throw it to the outer reaches of our solar system. And that fits the model we're seeing now. When that will happen, I think, will be, during the tribulation time. But we know from the Bible that there'll be a 1,000-year period after all this happens, that the earth will be reconstructed and, things be put into harmony and life will continue. So it's not like saying go cut your wrist because it's going to kill everybody. However, the side of the planet facing that event will be in trouble. And I've often thought, since America has become like Babylon, taking in so many languages and people and, different gods and religious systems, it's like a modern version of the old Babylon. It's not a good thing. And that if the side of the planet was Earth, on Earth that was facing this event, was the United States and South America, we've got seas to the west, seas to the east, so that if this event happened, it could fry America in a few minutes. Now, that if that were Babylon of the Bible, the modern Babylon, the in 1 hour, everything would be fried, dead, gone. And the merchants of the earth would throw ash on their head and say, woe is us, who's going to buy our goods? That might be that America gets clobbered that way.
Wow, that's really, really interesting. Hey, I'm thinking, what about, say that's down the track, something like that, but if there was perhaps a similar thing to the Carrington event, but maybe not on quite this big a scale, and people wanting to communicate and all of that, if it knocked things out, what's the options? I mean, ham radio, all that sort of thing, CB, RT, all of the various things. How would people be able to get communications to each other best?
Well, you know, that's going to be problematic because the different frequencies are going to come out of the sun after all this changes happen or during the process. It's going to knock out a lot of our satellites that we use for cell phones, communication that way. Ham radio, you know, you have to have a really big unit to go around the planet without some kind of augmentation or relay stations. So a lot of those will be taken out as people use satellites to communicate around the planet. However, we are suggesting that ham radio systems be developed, be set up to have EMP shielding so that we can communicate on a ham radio frequency or frequencies that are working at certain times of the day. And we won't know until it happens what bands will work because it's going to ionize the atmosphere, you know, not just in the direct impact area, but around the sides of it. It might even go all the way around the planet. So, ham radio will be good and essential. And in the United States and South America, or, you know, the northern part of South America, that might be fried and that would be sad. But the rest of the countries, you know, China and Europe and Middle East, they would be able to communicate on a very basic level. And sometimes I wonder when the Battle of Armageddon is described in the Bible that they're going to be riding horses. And you think, horses?
I've been wondering that too.
What happens if all your electronics on your tanks, your aircraft and naval vessels are fried? You're going to go back to the horse and buggy. You're going to have to do it the old way. We're fighting is between soldiers and not between electronic devices. And that might explain why that happened.
Because I've often wondered about that myself, actually. So you make a good point.
Yeah, well, I try to defend the Bible and the prophecies and the history of the Bible and all that I do. And that's why I tried to and did successfully find the Garden of Eden. That's a key point for all religions on the earth. That's where we started. And I found the place, been there. And then what was Atlantis? Well, it was a part of the fallen ones mating with the children of Adam and Eve in the Saudi Peninsula. So now we go to from what was past to what is future. And I said the same kind of argument was, what could create these conditions the Bible speaks of that seem anomalous or impossible? Why would we use horses? And this is what I came to, was that kind of thought.
That's a very good point. Okay, now just moving on slightly, I'm interested in the earthquakes and volcanoes sort of situation as well. Seems to be a lot of that happening. And, I was looking back through, even in New Zealand, you know, what are some of the biggest ones that we've had? Well, obviously volcanoes, Taupo is going to be, that's the ultimate. There's been some pretty big earthquakes in New Zealand's history since we've been settled by Europeans that we know of, and including probably the worst one was Wairarapa in 1855, where that did a lot of damage. Obviously, there weren't a huge number of people here, but it did some fair damage, and it also sent a tsunami. You know, it was apparently 10 or 11 meters, that's 33 to 36 feet tall, and that could affect even somewhere where I am, in the not that far from that Wairarapa. And there's all kinds of others that we've had in New Zealand. So I'm thinking, yeah, being prepared for disaster is important. And I really encourage people to do that. And I know you and Holly have put out books on, you know, well, Dare to Prepare. But you could never prepare for a Taupo eruption.
Well, yeah, one way you could prepare is to move out of North Island. Pick up shop and leave. One of those early eruptions you were talking about, was that the one where the Maoris, the ghost ship came past?
Oh, that was Tarawera. That was in 1886 or something like, or 83. No, this was not a volcano. The one I meant was just an earthquake. But the Tarawera one, well, that was the last big volcanic eruption in New Zealand. But gee, that's still small compared to what could happen in Taupo.
Well, I've been looking at White Island, which I'm sure most of you have too, and that serious eruption we saw there in the last month and killing those tourists and stuff tells us that White Island is active and it's a threat. The GNS people we talked to down there told us that, look, White Island is the zipper, and when it goes, it's going to unzip the fault lines all the way down to Taupo, and beyond a bit, and volcanoes will start to erupt, and perhaps that's what's going to trigger Taupo. So watching White Island is, very important. It's a it's a barometer. It's the canary for the big disaster of earthquakes and volcanoes. I've been trying to figure out, if I were in North Island and lived there, where would I go, you know, to have my home and business that would be least affected by such an eruption? And I end up thinking maybe up in the northwest on that little peninsula that sticks out there, maybe. But there's not much there to live on. So I don't know. South Island will probably be shaken up quite a bit too, but I think because it's on the other side of the slip fault that it might be more stable when all this change occurs. Right now we have a slow sliding earthquake on the east coast. Are you aware of that one?
That's the what Kermadec fault. Is that the one? Is that where that is?
Well, on the east coast of New Zealand, there is what's called a slow slip earthquake happening. It's in slow motion, and it's moving whole sections underneath the ocean there. And when it gets to a tipping point, then we're going to see, you know, damage to the east coast of New Zealand and offshore and tidal waves as well, I'm sure, when it finally converts to an active earthquake instead of a slow slip like that. It's creating stresses and things that are going to have to be relieved sometime. Yeah.
It's a bit freaky. I've experienced so many earthquakes since I've lived where I am in this part of the North Island, which has been, I've been here for, I don't know, 13 years or something now, 12, 13 years, and maybe 14. And you know, I'd never really experienced earthquakes like I have here until then, but you never quite get used to them because you're always wondering whether, I hadn't felt one for a couple of years, and we had one about a week ago, which was only 4.4, but it was directly pretty much underneath me, and I was thinking, this is not really a big event, but you're always wondering if something bigger will follow it. And that's the reality. And of course, yeah, they had the Christchurch earthquakes in 2010 and 2011 down in the South Island, which the second one killed, I think, about 200. I should just check on that. How many people did it kill? 185 people. So they can happen anywhere, really. I don't think there's anywhere you can go where you can categorically say you're safe from these sort of disasters. I mean, obviously, if Taupo went, well, we're probably all toast, even though from where I am or whatever. But
you could all be astronauts suddenly.
Jettisoned, but yeah, I mean, we never know when it'll happen or whatever. But there's certainly plenty of other earthquake possibilities with that. But yes, I mean, because obviously Taupo to you is a big one because you've had that dream, which you've shared on the show before, which people may want to check out the full dream you had. I think you've maybe shared it a couple of times on the Minute to Midnight show.
Yeah, let me just check while we're talking here on our website. I think Holly has that in some of Stan's, whatever you call it here, dream visions. Yeah, on the top of our homepage, standao.com, and the white titles up there, it's one that says Dream Visions. And Dream Vision 2, maybe 1997, 96. Yeah. Yeah, there's two or three of those that are related to the Taupo event. You can read it there. I was thinking the other day when I was looking at the Taal volcano, you know, the T-A-A-L one that's erupting down in the Philippines, and on our show images page, I show pictures of that where it's just mighty, and it hasn't blown its full head yet. And they were saying there that the old crater for the Taal volcano was, you know, silent for such a long time that it had a lake in it. And then all of a sudden, the lake, the dirt underneath it there was fractured by the fault line that runs through that volcano, and all the water drained down into the hot magma underneath the Taal volcano and blew the heck out of it. That's just a preliminary blow. The rest of it's coming. And so I looked at the before and after pictures of the Taal volcano where the water was, or as it was then, and after the initial explosion, and it's just drained. And I thought about Taupo then. I thought, good grief, you know, this is like Lake Taupo. Well, we were down there talking to the GNS engineers and scientists down there. They said that they were always watching the water level on Taupo to be sure that there was enough water there to put a heavy weight on the cap, the dried or cooled cap of the Taupo volcano underneath. And they worried when the water level started to drop. Well, the Taupo volcano, when they analyzed that, they were saying that the fracture sucked the water down in. That it's a peculiarity of the surface of the Earth that over a magma pool. The magma makes the ground between the top of the magma pool and the surface soft and elastic, and it will go up and attach to the crust underneath the volcano, and then start to pull it down by its weight, and that will pull the cap down, regardless of whether you've got weight on top to hold it in place, and that will cause the fracture and the water to go down into the volcano and make a huge steam exploding volcano that's like a bomb. So I'm wondering, you know, when I had the dream vision of Taupo, I saw like a train car full of people, various mixes, whatever, descending into Lake Taupo without knowing what was happening. And they were going down before the explosion. And I never figured that out until I read this article a couple of days ago. I thought, right, the magma has to connect and pull it down. And then when all that water sinks in, boom. Anyway,
I mean, it's sobering. I hope it's past my lifetime, but I mean, I don't know if we're going to be here that long. So, yeah, but Taupo is just one of the, I think, seven biggest in the world, isn't it? Super volcanoes, calderas or whatever. And you've got a couple of them in America too.
Long Valley and Yellowstone. And then there's some under the ocean that have been, there might be about seven of them around the place. And I'd hate to see them all go off at once. But
Even if one of them goes, is there anything happening of note in America or on the faults and, you know, with earthquakes and volcanoes and things?
I've been seeing some small signs, small flurries of earthquakes and not large ones over in the New Madrid area. And also in Ridgecrest, there's been thousands, tens of thousands of them, smaller quakes happening there. And what I suspected might happen has started to happen in that the Ridgecrest earthquakes are moving down the Garlock Fault over toward the Pacific Ocean to connect with the San Andreas Fault and several other faults that are parallel. So because of that, we know the magma is coming up at a second level over at the Ridgecrest rather than over at San Andreas. And so this is welling up, telling us that we think that the break in the western coast crust is in progress. The magma is so close to the surface for the last 10 years that the California Department of Energy has been figuring out ways to drill holes down into the magma and use it as thermal energy to generate power from the heat. But it's now moving up so close to the surface that might be a bad idea.
Okay. So what about the Puerto Rican earthquakes? Is that connected?
That is an unusual group of quakes. I've been studying that, trying to figure out, you know, from what we can see in the mud maps of the bathymetry around the area, where the fault is it's causing that and what movement is causing that. It's so localized, you know. I don't know why it's happening. In fact, I think it's puzzling to a lot of the geologists who do that full time, why it's happening there. But the earthquakes have been coming larger. Normally you think if you have a Richter 6, okay, then it'll be Richter 5s and 2s and 3s, aftershock. But the aftershocks have been getting bigger. So why? I mean, that's telling us something big is about to happen there, and I just cannot figure out what is causing that in that particular location. It's so localized.
Yeah, well, that is seemingly unusual. It must be an alarming if you're in Puerto Rico. Actually, it was very interesting. I know that when they had one of the quakes, the big one, the first of those, that it knocked out power, and I think 97% of the island. And it made me realize straight off that if people are not prepared, it's too late to prepare after you have something like that. If your power's gone, you can't get gas because there were long lines of cars trying to get gas. The gas stations were all shut. If you haven't got your food, well, your supermarkets are all going to be closed and things. And it's why I think it's pretty crucial that people are prepared for such
things. Yeah. I mean, look, people say, okay, well, I'll have my car and some gasoline, but you say to them, okay, that's good for, a period of time, but the gas stations aren't going to be working anymore and there's going to be looters around. So you've got to look at maybe a bicycle or something like that you can use, human power to get around with. not be so obvious. Keep yourself safe. But the loss of electricity is going to be a real hurt to the planet. And I go back to the Armageddon type discussion we had earlier about how they were using, you know, conventional horses and stuff like that rather than electronic devices for the war. It does make you think that you get prepared for that kind of an eventuality where you live, not just the war. Hey, on that note, you know, Qasem Soleimani, you know, General Soleimani over in Iran. Okay. He's on slide 13. I have all the time on my show images page. He's one of several people that I describe as being potential antichrist to this age. You know, you can pick any of them you want, but there are two of them that stand out in the evidence I've been able to collect. And one of them was General Qasem Soleimani, who got bombed and killed. And the other one's Mohammed bin Salman, the prince of Saudi Arabia. Now, both of them have in common in my clue list something unusual. Nostradamus, not that I'd say trust everything Nostradamus says or any of it, but unusually, he said, look, the Antichrist of this age will be called Mabus, M-A-B-U-S. And Mohammed bin Salman is called MBS in the halls of power there in Saudi Arabia. And he has set up an Arabic Union, AU, of the 33, I think it is, Arab countries. So he's got MBS and AU, plug it together, it's Mabus. So that's not the only reason I look at him, but that was one thing from Nostradamus that stood out about this guy. I thought, well, that's interesting. Then you look at Qasem Soleimani. Nostradamus said something about the Antichrist of this age. It fits him. And Nostradamus said the Antichrist of this age would fight a 27-year war. Soleimani fought the West for the last 20 years, and now he's dead and can't have another 7 years. Oh, wait. Suppose he had a body double, and he does come back to power. Now that he could receive a head wound, they could doctor him or look alike, you know, to have head wounds so that he comes back to power, and you could take a body double for him and artificially remove any of the identifying scars or marks as part of a wound he suffered in that attack. And the people of Earth would be astounded at this guy. And that would fulfill the 27-year period that Nostradamus predicted the Antichrist this age. So I'm kind of hanging around saying, when are they going to announce that Soleimani is back? You know,
crazy. As you say, I wouldn't personally trust Nostradamus at all. But
definitely.
It's interesting. That's certainly interesting watching those people. And I watched Mohammed bin Salman after, you know, you sort of mentioned him quite some time ago about that. So, just kind of backtracking a little bit, our time's sort of running along. I just wanted to ask you what your thoughts are about the solar minimum. Are we actually heading towards, which direction is the climate actually going? Are we heading towards colder overall climate, or is it going to be that we get extremes at both end of the spectrum, or how's it going to work?
I think you're probably correct on that we'll see extremes on the spectrum: extreme dry, extreme wet, extreme cold, extreme hot, and because of the Earth's magnetic field tilting and moving like it is, like I said, the sun itself is the driver for all this, and this solar cycle. We're in 25 now. We're coming out of a trough, and we're starting to see early signs of sunspot activity increasing on the sun. So it's not just humming along like always, you know, so hum, you know, ho hum. This is the way it was last time. It'll be that way again. I think we're going to see some changes in this solar cycle that will surprise us a bit. Let me just check with NASA here while I got you on the horn here. I'll try to look at it quick, because they had something, an article the other day I ran across about this solar sunspot cycle. Nah, can't get it to come up. The internet's frozen on me. But anyway, the situation on Earth in relation to the sun is getting very dicey. And they've known that changes were coming since 1992 when those two ultraviolet frequencies started coming out of the sun that I told you about. And they've made clear to military and observers that work for the government, don't make this a thing that you officially endorse. We don't want to start a panic. But things with the sun and with our magnetic field of the planet are so big that we can't hope to stop them or change them. They're going to do what they're going to do. So like you've been saying, prepare. You know,
on that note then, How would you advise people to prepare?
Well, first of all, you know, do it logically and not in fright. Assume that your area is going to be one that survives, you know, whatever catastrophes come, whether it's war or nature. And do like you were talking about, to have your own water and being able to filter it. Have maybe solar power or wind power, some crude windmills and stuff to pump water out of your well or to just, you know, generate electricity for you. You won't be able to live, you know, with all the electronics that we have now, like fridges and freezers and air conditioning and stuff like that, because that takes up too much power. But just, you know, look at the biological necessities, food, shelter, medicine, water, you know, and prepare that as best you can. I mean, some people live in apartments. Some people live out in a property where they have room to spread out and put in a water tank and stuff like that, or have, you know, their own cows or sheep. It's just going to be, you know, good luck, but don't panic. Just do what you can and nothing more. You can never prepare it completely. I mean,
No. And I guess as getting to know what God wants you to do, where he wants you to be, and how he wants you to prepare as an individual, I suppose, it's like being plugged into, you know, hearing God's voice is important, and being able to know, because otherwise you can be willy-nilly trying to prepare for everything and doing it, you know, and you can't. So we have to have that wisdom.
Well, that brings up a good point, though, which Holly and I have both stressed in our books and interviews and stuff, is that the first, you know, the most important preparation is to get your life right with Christ and with our God, because one way or another, sometime or other, we're going to meet him. So let's hope it's on good terms. And that's the most important preparation. After that, he will take care of you if you do it yourself, if you do all you can. I'm sure that he will be there to help people.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. So on a small sort of thing, what about if people want to get a hold of your EMP shields? Can it be only done in America, or is it available for people, general public, or how can they do this?
Yeah, we do have models for the general public. We have European models, and we have models that you can use in New Zealand and Australia. For several months, we could not sell it to you because the government, because of the nature of it, has to approve export of this out of the United States. But they've now released that restriction, and we're able to sell in New Zealand and Australia and most of Europe.
So how would they do that?
Go onto our website, empshield.com, and there we have drop-down menus at the top that show you what kind you need for your home or for your RV or for your cars, you know, all the different kind of applications where you need to protect the electronics from the EMP pulse. If you go to that thing and order units, you can use my founder's code, because I'm one of the founders of the company, and just put in DEYO, D-E-Y-O, and then a hyphen and the word shield, and it'll give you $50 off of the current price of any units that you buy. And sometimes we have sales, you know, like holidays, like, you know, I don't know whether they're going to have one for Valentine's Day, but we've had several this year for, you know, national holidays. And that way you get an extra deduction or your bonus. I know one month we were having people buying units that were getting $125 off the list price of, you know, like $399 with minus $125. So you just pick your time. You can get them, but when you order, write in the comments section. If you got a comment section in your shopping cart and say, look, I live in Australia. Can you ship this to me, and are there any extra shipping charges? We ship for free here in the United States, but overseas, obviously, we're going to have a little extra postage. And you can write to me, too, at standeo@standeo.com. If you're not sure you're part of the world is serviced by our device, you know, write and let me tell you what we can do. I think at the moment there are no places, no power systems that we know of that our device won't work for. We've gone over the planet looking at the different connectors and things and voltage levels. And the voltage levels are the most important thing for us, because we want to put a head of about 5 to 8% for our cutoff. When the voltage rises 5 to 8% over whatever your local voltage is, we're going to say it's an EMP pulse and disconnect everything from the mains. So, yeah, we'll help you. Just do whatever you can.
So can people get to that off your standeo.com website?
Yes, they can. I'll just pull up our site here and look at it real quick. standio.com, you roll down about a third of the way through the full site, and you'll see a picture of an EMP shield device. And big blue letters, protect your home and business from EMP, our biggest threat. And you go down, there's three or four paragraphs that Holly's put up there. And right toward the bottom of it, the third line from the bottom, it says, when ordering, either online or through Stan, you know, blah, 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 here's your code. And if you click on the online link, it's hard linked into our EMP Shield company. And that's where you look at all the different options and what it takes to install them. We even have instructions to show you how easy it is. And that's about it. And we do field questions for people that have got properties that have different power supplies all working together, like solar and wind and the mains and that kind of stuff. There are questions that come up for RVs, people protecting their cars and their remote, or what do you call it, RVs anyway. Any questions, they can email us and we'll try to answer as best we can. Tony, you can also tell your listeners to visit our website, standeo.com, S-T-A-N-D-E-Y-O.com. And right up at the top of the page, you'll see the sign that says YouTube. And underneath that blue letter will say show images or recent interviews as well if you want. But show images. And if you click on that, it'll bring up four boxes of different hosts that I do shows with. And the Hagman Report's the one that I always keep current. And you click on that Doug Hagman link, and it shows the week's worth of news stories that I thought were important to talk about on the show. And for Americans, at the very top of the page, it's got the DEFCON, the defense level. And we tie into the government site that tells us whether we're at DEFCON 1 or 5. If we're at DEFCON 1, it doesn't matter. The world is coming apart. But anyway, that's updated live on there, as are the other news stories. And then there are a lot of things that are not changed every week, which are good references down at the bottom of that page. Interesting reading. So that might help your guys.
Awesome. Well, we've covered quite a lot of important stuff, I think. So it's been great to have you on the show again today, Stan.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate it. Always good to talk to you.
Excellent. And we'll have to do it again in 2020 before too long.
Yeah. Yep. Good.
Folks, don't forget our website, aminutetomidnight.com, and you can visit us there. And all of our A Minute to Midnight shows you'll find on YouTube and on iTunes and also on our website. And A Minute to Midnight is run by donations 100%. We really appreciate it when people do help us out. Can't keep the show running without your help. And not a huge number of people do, and if you would like to help us, but I'm so grateful to them, those that do. But if you want to help out as well, you can donate at aminutetomidnight.com. You'll find links there to donate to us. The music used in the shows I've written, played, and recorded, and we have a Facebook group and also a forum on our website. Don't forget to hit the like button on this if you're watching it on YouTube, and also share it. So that's about it for this episode. Hopefully, God willing, we'll be back in a few days' time with another show. Until then, this is Tony saying goodbye and God bless.